Welcome to Town Square. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. As always, our weekly conversations include you. And if you'd like to join the discussion, the phone lines are open at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. In the next 10 days, there will once again be commemorations of the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The ethical debate lives on, too, along with calls for nonviolent diplomatic solutions to conflict. And meanwhile, so does the practice of war. Most people are shocked at reports of civilians killed or maimed, especially when those civilians are women and children. But the U.S. and many other countries have historically engaged in practices to win wars that have injured and killed civilians, their own and those in other countries. Even with the Geneva Conventions, if winning is the objective, does a successful win mitigate our judgments of war of what is and isn't acceptable? Those are just some of the questions we'll consider tonight on Town Square, a conversation few want to talk about, the strategy and psychology of war. My guests are Brad Glosserman, Executive Director of Pacific Forum CSIS and Hawaii Pacific University Social Sciences Chair and Professor of Peacemaking and Conflict Management, Carlos Juarez. And again, if you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 941-3689. Or 877-941-3689. Thank you both for being here.
Well, thank you, Beth Ann, and look forward to a conversation here.
Thanks for having me.
For a lot of people, this is not going to be an easy conversation because it brings up all kinds of ideas, things perhaps that we have been taught as kids, ideas that come in conflict with what we've learned as adults. But given human nature and all its permutations, the root question that we're looking at tonight is, can there really be compassionate warfare?
Gosh, well, that's a tough word, compassionate warfare. I mean, one of the realities that we live in, and anybody who looks at the headlines today, you can see a pretty bleak environment, conflicts, deadly conflicts that are in many parts. Our own instinct is to want to obviously avoid that, to eliminate that. And yet, is it a world in which we will always have that? I mean, one could say since the dawn of when people came out of caves, we've been beating each other over the heads. But the fact is, today in our globally connected world, we continue to see violence and conflict. While we may strive to eliminate it, it's a real challenge. There's no easy answer, and often the choices are between bad and worse options. And, violence continues, and it's a tough dilemma, ethical, morally.
Well, you talk about since people were crawling out of caves, it makes me think of that moment in 2001 where you see the monkey pick up a bone and slap somebody else over the head. And after he's done this one upside, the head begins to do a lot. And then, we know what sort of resulted from all of that. Is there a possibility that we can actually get to a point of having diplomacy rule and not warfare, given humans as they are?
I think some people would suggest that that's sort of an artificial dichotomy. I mean, in the sense that we do, in fact, have laws of war, even an anomalous or oxymoronic as that might sound. And the tragedy, of course, is we live in a world in which there really – that power prevails and that there isn't a larger structure of institutional authority, an anarchic world that Hobbes would have said. And so in the absence of some – authority that's able to enforce norms and justice, bring justice to all, that every state has to do what they can or every group tries to do what they can. And the result is, unfortunately, times when conflicts can't be resolved. And while everybody professes to want to have peaceful resolution of disputes, the tolerance level and the threshold for diverting from the path of peace differs from society to society and, sadly, from time to time. So,
I mean, in our times now, we hear very much those who say we have to have a strong defense. That's how we show that we are a strong nation. We don't want to appear weak. If it's a diplomatic solution, maybe it's going to be a weak solution. Is that a fault of ours in not understanding what greater strength might be or could be?
There isn't a good answer to that question. I mean, the fact of the matter is that there are always going to be individuals, I'm afraid, and larger associations of individuals for whom the law doesn't seem to hold much value. And again, in theory, we rely on the police within a society to enforce order and to protect us. And yet, more broadly, there's still crimes and there's still violations of persons and property and such that I suppose that certainly explains the appeal of the Second Amendment groups that argue we always have to be able to defend ourselves. That's the case in microcosm. But diplomacy and war are parts of a continuum, and it all has to do, I think, with the resolution of disputes.
Carlos, you've made the point that sometimes when you stop a war, that in fact it ends up prolonging it because there are many things that don't get resolved. I mean, many have argued that the First World War was a prelude to the Second World War, and that's why we had it, because there were many issues that didn't get taken care of appropriately. First time around, 20 years later, enough of a buildup, a different generation, and it was ripe for war again.
Yeah. And here are the challenges. We're talking about war, but the fact is there are many different types, and the nature of it has changed itself. I mean, when we speak of the great world wars of the early 20th century, these were massive scales, countries, crossing borders with huge armies. We don't see that much in the sort of, late 20th, early 21st century. The nature of war is now more likely to be within states and ethnic and religious in nature. But the point I was saying is we had a conversation before about this is, war, we don't like it. It's abhorrent. It's awful. And so we want to do, our gut instinct is to want to prevent it and stop it. And yet, in some sense, almost if you have a view of the world that sees the law of the jungle prevailing, sometimes, it needs to play out in its own way. That's not to suggest we should just let wars go on, but that, there might be conflicts that if they don't play out in some way to resolve themselves, you're simply, putting off, things will fester until they do. It's a challenge. I like what Brad was speaking to briefly, because one of the challenges, as a professor here, I try to help students understand the nature of war. And a perennial question is, why do nations go to war? I mean, why can't we figure out a solution? And, it's not an easy answer. Part of it is described by the nature of the system, the international system, this notion of an anarchic world. What it means is that we don't have a world government. We don't have some, organization that's just going to come in and do that. So states look out for their own interests. And from that view, you then have this perspective we often call realism, that it's a dog-eat-dog world and you got to take care of your own. But that then creates essentially a vicious cycle, because in doing that, you're then putting fear into the other side and they're going to respond, and it creates a cycle of mistrust. And often, actually, there are many conflicts where neither side intended or wanted to go to war, but that mistrust, the misperception, ends up sparking a violence that no one really wanted. It's a tough challenge for us and very complex.
None of this, what I hear both of you say, is that there isn't obviously a perfect answer. There's not a way that all of us are going to move to the same page, because we are, after all, human. But when you have populations with deep-seated, not just mistrust, but hatred, and you can pick populations, many of them from around the world, how to allow one to protect itself and not to have its population put into jeopardy, whether it's intrastate or two states going to war with each other?
Hatred is the easy case. I mean, when you've got longstanding enmities or grievances, of course you're always worried about making sure that you've got the ability to protect and defend yourself. I think the more interesting case, and frankly probably the more realistic one, is just in a world of such extraordinary diversity, in which case societies are nevertheless interacting at the level at which they do, there's always the opportunity for misunderstanding. There's always the opportunity for mistakes. And I think most of the people that are working on questions of war and peace these days are more concerned about inadvertent escalation or missteps that take us into conflict. And in these situations, I mean, the prevailing presumption is that you need to at least have the capacity to defend yourself. And Carlos is right, of course, to see that what one person's legitimate defense is another person's aggression. And these build these spirals of misperception. But the premise, if you will, of the Cold War was always that large nuclear arsenals that were capable of visiting such immense destruction, mutual assured destruction, was sufficient to alarm both sides and to force them to be calmer than they might otherwise be. Having this ability to defend yourself is, in fact, a means not of being really able to wage war, but a way to wage peace. We were having a conversation. My organization works precisely on these questions in the Asia-Pacific region. And so last week I was having conversations with Japanese and Koreans and Americans on a lot of these issues. And one of the Japanese participants pointed out that the among Japan or Japanese, the majority view really is a sense that based on history and culture and acculturation, that most Japanese today sort of see the military as being a force for war and unable to understand how militaries can be a force for peace, how they can deter other countries by their presence, by their capacity, their ability, if you will, to both defend and perhaps even to fight, can keep other countries from making aggressive steps or overestimating their capacity to change the status quo in the event of a grievance or some problem. So in this sense, we have huge military machines. But if you talk to the military forces, they would prefer that they never be used. That in fact, the purpose of this massive machine is to be a wasting asset that's never deployed in such a way that it takes human lives or upends the order in the way it is. But nevertheless, the preparation and the sense that they are ready to fight and prepared to fight is, oddly enough, preparation for peace.
If you've just joined us tonight, we're talking about the strategy of war and our psychology of war, how we regard it. We want to hear from you, too, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Long history of things that the United States has done, of many other countries. You can go back for thousands of years, the aggression that we've seen and learned about, but we don't seem to carry that forward as much as when we read it in history and we look out at the rest of the world. The question is, how does all of this mitigate how you look at war in 2014? 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Brad, you just talked about military would prefer, of course, not to go to war, not to waste lives, not to be engaged with that, and are more cautious about entering into that. But once a war is declared, once it's been committed, then what? Isn't the objective to win?
Obviously. I mean, that's why fight if you're not fighting to win? And if you have, you know, war is, according, says Clausewitz, politics by other means. It's an attempt to achieve particular political objectives. It wouldn't make sense to begin a war if your objective was not to prevail against that alternative force. To go back to something you were saying, and if I may, there's a famous saying that, you know, history doesn't repeat itself, it rhymes. And so it's difficult in many cases to learn lessons from history, and some of the best and most interesting books you read are either counterfactuals or are historical or academic studies about learning from history. And the truly, truly difficult task for someone who's trying to make a decision in these moments, apart from the extraordinary pressure that's on them because the potential costs and consequences of a wrong decision are huge. No one makes these decisions lightly. But nevertheless, is understanding what are the appropriate lessons to draw from history. And today the debate in the American politics is, are we repeating the mistakes of World War II?
Repeating Vietnam?
Is this appeasement? But so trying to understand how the new circumstances change the lessons and oblige us to apply these lessons, which and then in turn is additionally complicated by the filter of human psychology. The idea that we are rational animals and we make rational decisions is pretty laughable.
And to which the other layer on top of that is that war has changed.
Absolutely, as Carlos was saying, yeah. The way we fight is hugely different in the capacities to fight.
And I would add to that, I mean, the technologies of war, where now we have both ability of very, you know, small group of people, individuals, non-state actors, we might call them. So a lot of the conflicts these days are not between, you know, country and country, but maybe a group, an insurgent or some, you know, just, you know, small group of people who have access to weapons or who are otherwise using different means. And so the asymmetry is interesting, where you've got, again, maybe a professional army suddenly taking on a very small group. The technologies have really been a critical factor, as they always have been in warfare. Yeah. The other aspect is just the scale and scope that, you know, today we're bombarded, and understandably, given the crisis in, let's say, whether it's the hotspot in the Middle East or the recent, plane crash in Ukraine, those are the headlines and we see those. But guess what? Those conflicts have been going on for a while, of course. Moreover, if we look at, of course, the deadly stuff in, let's say, in Gaza today and faced by Israel, right next door in Syria, there's been a larger scale of violence in the last few years alone. But our media will tend to kind of look at things in different ways. And you know, meanwhile, we might have massive violence in Central Africa or other places that somehow aren't on the headlines. So I think that helps to shape some of our perceptions, too. I mean, people just only, you know, get their information from whatever sources and may not see the full picture.
Before we go to some of our callers, very briefly, do you think people actually have a greater grasp of history now, or has that been lost?
I mean, my quick answer would be to say we still don't know our history well enough, and too often, and even the news coverage of it is often devoid of any real context.
I would agree with that. We're inundated with information, and or inundated with data, and some of which is information and some of which is knowledge.
All right, we're going to go off to some of our callers now. If you'd like to join the discussion, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. We have with us tonight the Executive Director of the Pacific Forum, CSIS, and also, and that's Brad Glosserman, who just heard just a moment ago, and Hawaii Pacific University Social Sciences Chair, Professor of Peacemaking and Conflict Management, and a few other things, too, thrown in there, Carlos Juarez, too. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going to Bill, calling us from Hawaii Kai.
Aloha. Thank you very much for taking my call. Fascinating discussion tonight. Question open for all the panelists. One thing I noticed in the ongoing conflict with the Muslim terrorists and the Islamic extremists, a lot of name-calling going along, and a lot of appalling ignorance on the part of the long-term goals from many of the Western perspectives, when you realize, of course, in the Arabic, the world is divided into Dar al-Islam and Dar al-Harb, the world of Islam and the world at war. In other words, there can be no other outcome but total world domination and a world caliphate. Now, when you have that belief coupled with the idea of the 12th Imam and the way to bring about this essentially Muslim apocalypse of the Shiite variety is to foment a nuclear war, and then the 12th Prophet will come back and the world will be at peace. It will be Dar al-Islam. Some may say that's completely nuts and irrational, but people believe this, and they will have the capacity for nuclear weapons, and if they get it, if all they want to do is to attack Israel, kill all the Jews, and then spread all the infidels into a nuclear radiation wasteland, is there any rational approach to prevent that sort of attack?
All right. Thank you for the question. I mean, the bottom line of his question is, if you're talking to people who aren't playing the same game that you are, is there a rational conversation that can be had, no matter who it might be?
Well, yeah, this is a tough dilemma. I mean, first I would say, I mean, there are certainly those who hold these views, no doubt, and many of them are waging war, but we want to be careful. This is not a view that everyone is subscribing to, and certainly the majority of the Muslim world is not seeking, you know, somehow world domination or some of these more extreme views. Nevertheless, how do you deal with those who are? I mean, it is a real challenge, and I think, you know, it has to be called for what it is, and that these are very extreme views that simply shouldn't be, I guess, you know, tolerated or accepted. So we have to realize that that's how it is. We're main point would be, though, that this is not a view that everyone is subscribing to, and yet those who have the means are obviously pushing it, and and it's there, and we have to contend with that.
But if you have extremist folks like that who have power, and they have the power to wage war and cause great destruction, can you engage in any sort of rational dialogue with them? I mean, that it seems from what you've both said that's not going to be possible.
First thing I think is to echo, is to agree with Carlos about this. That's not a very common view or informed view, I think, of Islam. I would also note that no religion or group has a monopoly on extremism. I think you can find millennialists.
That's what I'm saying. It doesn't matter where it is.
But in that case, the answer to your question is that people that defy our, by definition, do not match our, that aren't rational by our standards, we can't engage them. I mean, by definition, we can't engage them. That's what irrationality means. So, and I suppose it's the equivalent of the individual within any society who happens to think they are a supreme being above the law, and for which they are alone, unique. And there's only one way to put those people to deal with them, and that is to eliminate them. And again, I think to capture them, to put them in prison, to somehow isolate them so that they can't harm other people. And I think that there is. Again, but you just have to make sure that you're identifying and getting the right people, that that you cannot classify a group. You cannot spread the net so widely that you take on innocence. And this takes us back precisely to the question you began with, is that if we identify some folks for whom our understanding of the way the world works and should work is utterly alien to them, then how do we engage them? And that's at the end of the day, that's what war is about, is a clash of ideals and principles such that we are unable to reach any rational resolution that protects the interests of both parties. And they both have the ability to escalate that conflict to the stage where we call it a war as opposed to a street fight.
We've got other callers on the line who want to talk to both of you, too. If you'd like to join the discussion, we're happy to have you. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going to Chris calling us from Makiki. Aloha, Chris. Thanks for your patience.
Hi. Thank you. My question, if your guest could apply some of the theory to the war in Gaza, and then also, what about the aftermath of war? I mean, you know, eventually this conflict will end, and what will the aftermath be for people in Gaza and for people in Israel? And what happens when war is over? What's settled or not settled? And I'll take my answer off here.
Thanks very much. Well, I mean, nobody has a crystal ball on this one to say, so what will happen in the aftermath? I mean, we can look at history in some ways. I mean, Germany was reincorporated back into the European family after the Second World War.
But only after the Second War.
Yeah, after the Second War. So doing immediately, what's the horizon on this? A lot of unknowns, a lot of questions. Do you want to take this on, Carlos?
Yeah, well, it's a tough dilemma. And you know, on one hand, we're seeing, of course, this most recent episode. It's simply one of of many that have been before. And, you know, on one hand, you have some that will throw up their arms and say, well, this has been going on forever and it's just going to continue. And yet, on the other hand, this current crisis will, we hope and likely, reach some point where it will come to a ceasefire, to an end. But what's the aftermath? Well, this is the real challenge. You know, some would say, well, after this is over, Israel will be in a, you know, in a position to hopefully have gained, from its perspective, you know,
safety, security,
some measure of security. And yet the reality for at least Israelis, while they do live under that, they have a world and a form of government, a quality of life that is certainly much, you know, higher than what's left in Gaza. Gaza is a pretty tough environment, and the aftermath is going to be, well, obviously what we've now seen on TV, a pretty bombed infrastructure. And you know, you've just fueled more, you know, the some might ask, you know, have we simply just extended more hatred? It's probably fair to say that the peace process is a little bit on the back burner for now. It'll be some time. But maybe a broader question, another way of answering is that what is the aftermath? Well, the hope and the goal of any, you know, conflict resolution is that you move beyond that, that they can begin to address solutions that do not move to armed violence. And so what does that mean? Well, some negotiation of some sort where they can move into a process of self-governance, autonomy, a two-state solution, that somehow, you know, if we're not talking about conflict and violence, you know, whether we call it democracy, and democracy is simply a way of addressing and solving your problems peacefully, you know, it comes in many shapes, and we have to, as Americans often realize, our system is not likely to be found in others. But looking at the current violence there, it's a really painful one because, there's no easy, clean cut, either analysis or solution. There's a lot to be critical about Israel. There's a lot to be critical about Hamas and what it has continued to do in its own way. We often note about this conflict that, you know, it may be well that 70, 80, if not 90% of the people on both sides really would rather figure out a solution, and that you've got pretty powerful interests, you know, whether we call them extremists or just well-entrenched interests, that will push, you know, a harder line, whether on either side.
Push the body count to be able to keep it going.
Sure, and each side has a vested interest. I mean, some could argue that Hamas has a vested interest in somehow continuing this because it a settlement probably is not going to gain them as much. And for the Israelis, I mean, they've got to be able to come back and show that what they've made this decision to intervene in such a massive way, that it's going to provide some better future of stability, or that they have degraded this threat from their perspective enough that they can go back to, you know, the previous status.
Brad, you want to weigh in on this?
No responsible decision maker, responsible, will go into a conflict and deploy military force without understanding ahead of time what the end state is. I mean, that's invariably what you've seen dominating discussions in the United States over the last few years, particularly given the decisions that were made in the early part of the 2000s in the George W. Bush administration, and a failure to grasp in the entirety what the outcomes could be and what our desired end states are, and how is it that the actions that we take are going to get us to that end state. And so I think, you know, the arguments of the Obama administration in every sense of as it's assessed the options has been, where does this get us? If we intervene in the deployment of military force, how does this help us achieve our objectives? What does this create? What is the where's the next step of that? And having seen how badly we have miscalculated the impact of American intervention in the last 10 years, this administration, I think, has been incredibly skeptical and very, very tight-fisted in its use of force, understanding the many uncertainties. And unfortunately, in some cases, you can't control for all the uncertainties, as well as, I think, dealing with a public that is incredibly fatigued by war and truthfully wants to be disengaged and, in some respects, disengaged from the world. The broader this invites a broader discussion of American foreign policy. But the question becomes, what is the role that America plays in the world, and how is it that we maintain a body of support among the public given this fatigue and given the immense problems that we have at home? So the conversations are about making sure that we don't do anything that might further undermine our ability to act. And by acting, I don't mean merely unilaterally, but certainly how is it that we can ensure that there are other countries willing to act with us, join us, because the only way the United States is able, I think, to create the outcomes that it desires and hopefully that other countries desire is acting with those other countries in ways that go beyond a narrow conception of American national interest.
Which takes us also beyond a concept that a lot of people have held for many years, that America is the leader in the world as opposed to one of the leaders in the world, to be acting on the world stage in a complement of countries, not necessarily the only one in the leadership position.
The word that's operationalized in the last couple of decades has been American exceptionalism. And no,
I wasn't going to go there, but that's okay.
We have to, because that's the language that they use. And I think there's a couple of important features of that. Number one is recognizing the limits of American power, and that as much as I like to say, we're very, very good at blowing things up. But the task is to rebuild things and to create peace, if you will. It's not merely to be able to wage war. And rebuilding things is something that takes a broader coalition of forces. What I think we're dealing with is a better and more nuanced understanding of the nature of leadership. You have conversations like we do throughout the region, and there's a sense that in the absence of American action that there will be an inability to fill the gap, to mobilize forces, to gird institutions and support norms, that the United States is needed in many ways to make sure that the world works and that peace is maintained. And that may be just us sort of interpreting what we want to hear. But there are, at the same time, a lot of people, and not just Americans, that believe that. And the fear is, of course, that in the absence of American action, or if we were to try to test whether or not the system would work without us, that the risks are very, if not too high. So it's a difficult position to be in, and the consequences of misjudgment are potentially very, very high. The result means that you have a very pronounced tendency to support the status quo and, at best, incremental and frustrating changes. When we see so many things that don't work, that nevertheless our readiness are to persist in that and to not risk great change, there's a lot of competing ideas and a lot of heads banging against walls.
All right, we're going to leave that one go for the moment because there are other calls and callers who want to talk to both of you, too. Going on now to Jack calling us from Pearl Harbor. Aloha, Jack. Thanks for your patience. Welcome to Town Square.
Thanks for having me on. I was wondering, since we're always going to have our own beliefs, each and every one of us, doesn't that create, make us separate from one another, whether it be by groups, whether Christian, or you believe that, you know, you're gay and gays should have rights, and you're Christian, that what gays do is wrong. We always condemn one another. We always judge each other. So doesn't that always lead to war, such as what's going on in the Middle East? The Jews in Israel believe that's their holy land, but then, you know, everyone hates them over there, or Muslim, because they believe that's their land, because we belong to a group.
Okay, let me get you an answer, Jack. He's just saying that given human nature, this is sort of where we were in the beginning of the conversation, given human nature, aren't we really always going to have conflicts and war and squabbles because we aren't evolved to a certain level? We all ascribe to a certain way of being that would make war anathema. Is that really what we are talking about?
I think we said, you're right, we did say this earlier, and I used the word diversity. And what Jack's talking about is tolerance. And clearly tolerance is prized more in some groups than others. And if you were raised in an environment that says tolerance is good and we need to be prepared to put up with diversity, then we have a greater capacity to accommodate differences.
All right, we're going to move off now to Paul calling us from Maui. Aloha, Paul. Welcome to Town Square.
Aloha. Thank you very much. What is the relationship between those who profit from war, for instance, the people who are the manufacturers of the materials of war, and the instigators of war? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Good question. And that seems to be right in your corner, Carlos.
Well, you know, there's no doubt that we have a world, certainly in our, not just our, we don't have a monopoly on it, but we have a very key stake in it. We have a very powerful sort of military-industrial complex. We have a huge weapons industry. And indeed, you can look around and let's say the hotspot of the Middle East. I mean, so many countries. The other day, I enjoyed a piece, I think it was on The Daily Show, where he showed all the various Arab countries and the millions, or I'm sorry, billions that they receive in aid from us. One can certainly see that there's a powerful industry and interests, maybe another way to put it. And are those, you know, an explanation for war? I mean, one could there is an argument for that there's a powerful vested interest. And certainly when we do have conflicts, there are some who gain from it. I mean, those, you know, we in the recent past, there's been a trend in the proliferation of private military contractors who obviously the concern there is, are they profiteering? Is that the, you know, or should we have those with the profit motive running, you know, this? The other is, are any another aspect would be, are our leaders, the policymakers, the decision makers who have close links and, you know, political leaders get funding from, you know, powerful industry, how much does that influence them, you know, to sort of promote that? These are tough issues. And I think ultimately, like a lot of things, it's how you see the world and you know, whether you see this as pluralism and, you know, everyone has their own stake, or if you see it as, hey, this is really what's driving it, then it's a more cynical view.
If you even know what's really driving it, because some of that you may never know.
That's right. No, it is. And yet a lot of it we do know. I mean, there's a lot of weapons procurement and there's a lot of movement of weapons. And we have an interest in it. We have, you know, the real difficult part is to say, you know, how much of that is really explaining the conflicts. I don't know. I don't think there's a clear answer.
Okay, so we get a resounding, I don't know. You want to come in here with us?
Brad knows.
You're wrong, Carlos. You're wrong. I would say the military-industrial complex is powerful politically, without question. But these weapons are enablers. I mean, we've talked mostly about diversity and a tolerance and of deep felt differences triggering so many of these disputes. I think that's really what happens. And the degree to which I think you can force people to build aircraft carriers because you distribute the production in ways that makes them more politically palatable. But at the same time, I don't think the aircraft carriers, the fact that we're going to build them means that we've got them, let's use them. I mean, in fact, as we've been talking, decision makers and particularly the people that are fighting and dying and potentially could be dying are the ones that are most restrained and most cautious and careful about their use. So the only causal link, and it's very, very, very attenuated, I would think, is that you have these huge militaries. They're out there doing things and perhaps they bump each other and they create situations where you have an accident. But the idea that there's a direct causal link between this, I'd be very skeptical.
Probably not,
about,
in your opinion. Okay.
Yeah, right.
All right. We're going to move on now. If you'd like to join the conversation, there's still time, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. We're looking at the psychology of war, the strategy of war. What are our judgments of war based on some of the history that we may know or may not know as we regard current events? 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. If you call us from the neighbor islands, use that last number. If you're on Oahu, 941-3689. Going now to David calling us from Kona. Aloha, David. Thanks for your patience. Welcome to Town Square.
Hi, thanks. I changed my question.
Okay.
Someone already talked about Gaza. If you could just comment on the differences as you see them between a citizen army, a professional army, and mercenaries, if you want to talk about them, and its effect on our decisions.
And the way that we regard war based upon who's fighting it?
Yes. You know, our decisions to
how to use military force
and when to use it.
Okay. Who wants to take that one first? All right, Brad, you're up.
Actually, it's a great question. And I think the answer is that while the notion of a broad-based war, which perhaps the citizen army is you know, that was the great transformation of warfare in the 18th century when you moved from the mercenaries to the French Revolution, Napoleon mobilizing all of the people, is that it galvanized the nation, and the animating spirits of patriotism in the country were suddenly driving behind it. It made the dogs of war, I think, it unleashed them a little more, made them more furious. But at the same time, when you have this larger body of people that are being affected, I think you're more inclined to weigh the consequences. That decision makers, quite frankly, the experience of the last decade has been essentially that when you insulate the country from the effects of a war, it's easier to fight it.
Yeah.
And so what we need in so many ways, the fact that we haven't felt that the majority of Americans have never had to feel the consequences, apart from, say, TSA searches, of the battle, the wars that we fought for the last decade, has meant that it's probably been easier for us to fight. And maybe we need to have a more distributed sense of the cost, the genuine cost of warfare, to make our decision makers a little more hesitant to march into those situations.
And how do you think that we would best get that?
One could talk about universal service in one form or another, whether it be conscription or personally, I think the idea that you could take people and if they don't want to go into the military, that they could go into some sort of social service elsewhere, the Peace Corps or something in the United States. Frankly, we have enough need for the mobilization of resources to work on our own problems. But clearly, the idea that you fight a war and you don't change the tax base in ways that oblige people to pay for it, at least, at the very least. But I certainly anything that better sensitizes the public to the genuine consequences of conflict is sadly a good thing.
No, I would echo that. I mean, I think it's critical. And when we, one of the issues of democracies, and we do have it, with our warts and imperfections, we have a democratic system. But to the extent that people are more engaged or connected as I think Brad was trying to put it, either informed or they feel it, they're likely to then pressure their leaders to be more restrained. One of the challenges I see is, well, we either have cultures, and indeed ours is one of those, a democracy where we are not as engaged, our participation rates in voting is relatively low. But on the other aspect is that when we do fight conflicts, as we do, and as we speak now, there are U.S. Soldiers in many parts of the world that people are not aware. It affects so few people. People are detached from it, and I think it kind of dehumanizes it on some level. The other aspect about these various parts, we've always had, mercenaries. They go back quite a long time, and even today we have private armies that, if you've got the money, you can contract people to show up and do something. The other is that the nature of some of the conflicts that we face now require a very, very stealth kind of, under-the-radar approach, and it might be our own professional armies that often do that, or it might be, just for purposes of having some deniability, there's even a certain privatization of what could happen there. So there's a different role for all of these, but more importantly, I think this notion of citizenship is critical when it comes to issues of war and peace. We need a society that is engaged and connected.
And every time we talk about having any sort of universal service, resounding no. I mean, just an absolute back away from all of that. It's good for somebody else, but maybe, not for me or not for you. If that's what we're up against too, how do we get over that hump, Brad, to really have people understand what this means, if in fact we are to understand what this means? Otherwise, we'll be back into what Carlos says, where we're just dehumanizing it because we're so far away from it and disengaged from it. It's not the Second World War.
There's not an easy answer. You know, at the end of the day, we talk about an informed citizenship. I mean, that's what representative democracy is about. And, you know, this, and it's difficult to be informed these days, number one, because there's so much information that's out there, and we tend to be so segregated in the way that we get our information that we get little silos of it that tend to conform to pre-existing belief structures rather than necessarily truth. And, of course, now what is the truth? But so –
So what you're really saying, I mean, it's easy to find people to agree with you, and that reinforces your beliefs, and on it goes.
Right. But at the same time, I mean, I say that to all of our HPR listeners, one particular silo. At the same time, you know, making a genuine – being part of a country, I think what you're dealing with at the nation at a base level of patriotism and is something – if you believe in it, it's something that's worth sacrificing for. And consequently – we believe in cheap and eat. We're a lazy nation in so many ways, or a lazy society, which is, you know, we believe in cheap and easy things that we would rather – that for us, patriotism is wearing a flag pin. And
talking a good game.
Right. And nevertheless, the actual making – you know, people believe in patriotism, but they don't really want to pay their taxes. Or people believe in a good fight, but they're not really necessarily prepared to make those – to make the sacrifices themselves, even when the sacrifice means, for example, paying the bills that come due. Whether it's in so many different ways. And this is such an incredibly charged discussion. But I think that the difference is that you make the people genuinely aware of what it means to be citizens in the entirety of that message, voting, participating, being part of the social life. I mean, we're venturing into some really broad and shifting terrain but incredibly vague. But it's really about at some point being prepared to pay some cost for the price of being a fully engaged citizen.
Well, that's our question to you. Are you here tonight? We're talking about war. Are you really engaged enough to be able to pay that kind of cost that Brad Glosserman was just talking about? We want to hear from you. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going to Nancy calling us from Kailua. Aloha, Nancy.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. When you were speaking about war and when you go into war, shouldn't you want to win it? Kind of the hairs on my neck stood up. I was wondering if you were trying to excuse Israel for bombing the school that was considered a UN facility for people to go in to take refuge. Because the Geneva Convention and the UN, their power is restricted at this point by how much money the U.S. has to do with supporting them. And you speak about how people in their patriotism, they don't want to – what have the wars been about? We don't even know why we went into Vietnam, and we don't know why we went into Iraq, and God knows why we went into Afghanistan. So I think the American people are fed up with all the double punches and the lies. And I'll take your answer off the air.
All right, Nancy. Thanks very much for the call. You know, she's going back to the idea that – why, you know, that we have such fatigue over our involvement in many wars. And speaking to your point or your question rather about asking about winning, my question was to the panel and asking the question that obviously people go into a war with the idea, as Brad, you mentioned, we talked earlier, to go into war to win it. I mean, you don't go into it to just be there, but what does winning mean? At what cost? Through what sense of standards are they? We talk about the Geneva Conventions, yet there have been many cases where those have simply been winked at, not necessarily taken into consideration.
Let's be clear that I wasn't certainly by any means advocating a disregard for the laws of war. I mean, they exist and states sign them because they exist for a good reason. You know, there's three ways to look at that. I think number one, you know, there is this notion that in theory, law, wars should be regulated and it's hard, and I think that what we see is probably more violations in the breach, meaning that we probably have far more ways that the laws of war are observed than they are disregarded. Number two, and this goes back to the other question we had or the discussion that we had about groups that are less – that don't respect the laws of war and that they're not necessarily countries. I mean, the fact of the matter is while Israel was absolutely wrong to shell a school, by the same token, they have now found, I believe, at least three cases where Hamas has actually hidden missiles in schools and been condemned for the United Nations by that. There are governments that are prepared to use human shields and are prepared to pay that cost because they see it as somehow being benefit. So
Which goes back to the point of winning it. What are you willing to do to win if you're going to advance your case, no matter what your case is, no matter which side it may be, are you willing to do?
And the difference then in the Israeli context, and to go to the broader question of Americans being fed up, if however you choose to characterize that, is that we're in a democracy. If, in fact, you are fed up and you're tired of being lied to, then change the people that lie to you. That's your right as a citizen. And if you being everyone is not prepared to engage, then you have no one to blame but yourself. And, you know, that's the difference between Israel, I suppose, and Hamas is that the leadership of Hamas is not elected by popular vote. You know, and for all the flaws, as Carlos noted, is that in democracies we have the ability to pick who leads us. And if we as a public, as a majority of a population, do not agree and feel as though we're being misled, then we should change these people. We have laws, and in the absence of a dictatorship, the usurping of power, we have the procedures that allow us to do that.
Nancy, thanks very much for calling with the question. Going now to Richard from Honolulu.
Yes, hello, everyone. Yeah, you know, I'm calling about the morality of war. Let me just say that, you know, we live in a dangerous world. I'm not advocating that we disarm or anything like that, but I think we need to understand that when we engage in war, you know, the exquisitely evil expressions that it causes us to do. I'm thinking, go back to World War II. I hear the justifications for dropping the bombs, nuclear bombs, on civilian targets. And you know, the justifications are powerful. But when you step back and look at it, it's just utter madness that allows us to reach that point. And when we step into a war, whatever side you're on, you go down this very dark path that allows you to do just extremely evil things, and you can justify it. I'd just like to hear some comments on that.
All right. Thanks very much, Richard, for the call. You know, that's been the heart of this whole conversation is what happens when you get to that point.
History is 20/20 hindsight. And at the same time, you know, we talked about the fact that how do you learn lessons from history? You know, how is it
which
that
history?
Right.
Yeah.
Which circumstances apply? And while I agree, you know, we were discussing earlier about the atomic bombings and the anniversaries that will come up, that is an extraordinarily charged situation. And you can go to Japan and you'll find very, very, very few Japanese that would ever say it was justified. And you will find very few Americans, not as probably the 99% of Japanese that see themselves as victims of the atomic bombings, but certainly a substantial majority of Americans that would argue that there were very, very powerful and compelling reasons that they're not prepared to reconsider even to this day.
And we'll never see a president go there and say, I'm sorry.
That's right. And at the same time, I think you also have to recognize that there are forces in this world where we can characterize Saddam Hussein as a regional bully or a potential, you know, a hegemon wannabe with if he'd gotten his access to his WMD. On the other hand, I think we can look at people like Adolf Hitler and who I think we would honestly say he was somebody worth fighting. And the problem, of course, is that there have been other world leaders that we might be equally quick to condemn, and yet for various circumstances we were prepared to make deals with.
And we made deals with Saddam Hussein and kept him in power.
Funny you should mention that.
All right. If you want to join this conversation, you can. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. We're talking about the psychology and strategy of war, things that are not easy to talk about. They're darn tough. It calls into question how we believe in so many ways about ourselves and about others. 941-3689, we want to hear what you have to say about the psychology of war. What's worth it? What's worth going to war?
If you don't have a caller, I wanted to know. I mean, one of the things that I think we pride ourselves on, and we've been sort of dancing around the subject a little bit in context of the variability of perspectives and questions of tolerance and like. But at the end of the day, we believe ourselves to be rational creatures and to be rational decision makers. And there's
most of us do.
Yes. And I think we all believe we're rational. Even when we're irrational, we think we're acting in rational ways. None of us say, well, I'm just going to be crazy for a while. But what we do end up, we frame things in ways that allow us to make decisions that make sense to us. Unfortunately, you know, there's an extraordinary body of social science research, and if Carlos would care to jump in on this as the social scientist in this group, I'd be happy to hear his thoughts, that, you know, that suggests in all sorts of ways there isn't really rationality to say, even on the basic human level, to say nothing of the larger sets of social, political, you know, societal issues that constrain and distort our decision making.
All right, you can jump in here for a couple of minutes, and we've got callers on the line who want to talk to both of you.
And I think to follow what Brad was telling here, I mean, one of the things I see is in a lot of wars and conflicts, you know, we go into them or you know, let's say leaders have taken us in, and the wars kind of take a different twist or a turn, or things happen that, you know, maybe, you know, change those dynamics and the initial assumptions fall through. I mean, again and again, whether it's, you know, maybe when the Germans, begin, you know, one of the world wars, the assumption is they're going to finish it in a few weeks or by winter, and you know, it just doesn't happen. There's also a certain notion, and maybe touching on what one of the early callers spoke about, the morality of war. I mean, the fog of war, once we're in this violence, I mean, it brings out, on some level, the worst in some people. And not just that, but again, it creates things that are not anticipated.
You're talking about also situational ethics, depending upon where you are and what's happening, and whether you want to get Machiavellian about this or not. But things begin to change based on the situation that you're in.
It's ugly. And you know, Brad said a few different ways and different times. I mean, one of the things that's interesting is that those who often are most likely to resist war are actually our military professionals. They understand both the limits. They also know that, again and again, they're often called upon without a real clear long-term solution. And so, you know, that people don't realize that. But those who are trained and professional in military affairs are often the least ones who want to push for it.
All right, let's take some more callers. Going to Patrick, calling us from Honolulu. Aloha, Patrick. Welcome to Town Square.
Hi, thanks for having me. I just wanted to make a comment. I do work with the military, and wanted to remind everybody that what we're willing to pay, we have to think when the soldiers get back. We have to continue to make sure we're supporting the young women and men that are coming back from these wars. Not only is there a cost up front, you know, to put them there to train them and the loss and casualty, but when they come back with PTSD, substance abuse, suicides, homicides, things like that, we have to be there for them. And I just wanted to put that out there. And
thank you, Patrick. We've had a lot of discussions about just those things, and I promise we will have more of them. Thanks very much for the call. Going to go off now to the Big Island and Walter. Aloha, Walter. Thanks for your patience.
Hi. I have a question, I guess, for you. Your panel. I was wondering if any of these people advocate the United Nations being the ultimate authority in this world.
Good question. I was waiting for somebody to ask a question like that. Thanks very much. I'm glad it was you, Walter. Thank you. You know, we've had a lot of discussions over the years on this program and certainly in the morning show about the efficacy of the United Nations and how it has changed in the last 15, 20 years, maybe the last 10 years, from being seen as not terribly powerful, not terribly in touch, people not awarding enough, perhaps, attention or gravitas. That's changed a little bit. But his point is, should that be sort of the ultimate authority?
You know, this, like so many things, kind of depends on your view of the world. And you know, often in here, I'm speaking from the sort of the professorial role, we often try to understand the nature of world politics from these, you know, it's oversimplified, but just for analytical purposes, you know, the sort of realist perspective of the world. It's a harsh place out there. There's a dog-eat-dog world. From that view, world government is not quite going to ever come to fruition. Countries are going to look out for themselves. There's always going to be some, you know, somebody sort of not playing by the same book. The other view, the more idealism, is one that's more supportive of the role of international law, of international institutions. And so, again, those are oversimplified. But, you know, how one falls onto that question is there. I would say this, that there is certainly an important aspect of war is that there's more to it than just the actual fighting. It's okay. We heard earlier, you know, what's the aftermath? Well, there's so much that happens after that deals with, you know, the reconciliation, the picking up the pieces, the sort of the so-called nation building. And those are things that, you know, armies and even countries are often reluctant or unwilling to do. I mean, waging war is one thing, but making peace and going the, you know, the next step to build a sustainable society. This is where what I want to say is that maybe international organizations, non-governmental organizations, and understand that the UN itself is not really world government. It, in many ways, it is simply more of a coordinating and facilitating role for the many other groups that are often NGOs, if you will. And there's an important role for those. There will always be that. Just like any place in the world where there's conflict, you're going to have Doctors Without Borders is going to show up, and they're going to patch up people's wounds, and they're going to, you know, they're just going to be there. Whereas you're not going to have armies just hanging around. Once they've done their job, they're going to go home, and they have a specific task. So a tough one, but I don't think we're going to see anytime soon any, you know, world government. And yet, will we see the role of the UN again? It's going to come and go in different ways.
All right, we're coming close to the top of the hour, so I want to get Brad in here too.
No.
Role of the UN.
No. The UN was designed to be, I think, in many ways, as Carlos described it, it's an organization that ultimately would be a place to, where intractable international problems would get dumped. Either countries that were directly involved in the situation would deal with it themselves, or their patrons would. So that if the United States can broker a deal between Israel and Palestine, it will do it. It's only when the United States can't that it goes to a larger body of where, you know, the UN is where intractable problems go to fester. They don't go to die because they keep getting worse. So again, in the absence of an international authority, it will always be a place probably more marked by its failures than by its successes, just by nature of what gets to the United Nations.
So you don't hold very much hope for the United Nations to be instrumental or helpful in certain cases with bringing together NGOs, with being able to facilitate some of the issues that Carlos just talked about?
Oh, no. It can very much do that. It can, like I said, the U.S. can blow things up.
It can
do a lot of the fixing. But I don't believe that it is, absent the political will, it's merely nothing. It's a convening authority, and it's a legitimating stamp for, you know, when other countries are trying to mobilize coalitions. But by itself, the U.N. Security Council is where the power is. There's five permanent vetoes. The Secretary General only acts, as you will, as the instrument of those five countries and the Security Council itself. So all of the powers are delegated. In the absence of that delegation, if any of these countries want to have a problem persist, it persists.
Okay, we're coming up to the top of the hour. I want to have both of you just give a final word on this, because wars are going to continue. I mean, in the absence of some great shift of mentality worldwide, we're going to see conflicts happen around the world. How would you leave people? What one thought would you leave?
Well, I think, and maybe it's, you know, of course, the educator in me, and that is, you know, as an informed citizen, we need to, you know, understand these things. You know, the easy thing, especially living as we do here, is tune out and just, you know, not pay any attention. But it is a world in which conflicts are there and they're likely to continue. I guess I just want to say we need to understand, study some history, get informed, talk to people about it, talk to people who have different views from you, and get out of your own comfort zone. I mean, too often we want to just hear what we like to hear, and that's comfortable. But you've got to challenge that, and I just encourage, you know, I know our listeners are you know, of many, many interests, but you've got to, I guess, continually try to learn about the issues. Every one of these conflicts have some kind of context, some history that if you don't understand it or know it, then you're not going to have an informed perspective about it.
Brad?
It's the extraordinary person, and I mean that in the most negative, unappealing sense possible, that sees conflict as the resolution to problems. You know, we in the setup, you talked about how we have this continuum, and virtually every government and every responsible decision maker I know looks for a peaceful, nonviolent solution. And so the question becomes, what happens when we deal with folks or deal with forces that refuse to accept that peaceful resolution, for whom the threshold for pain is lower or higher than others? And that's the gray zone for which there are never and will never be an easy answer.
But that means we will have more conversations. I want to thank you both for this one. Brad Glosserman, the executive director of the Pacific Forum, CSIS, and Hawaii Pacific University Social Sciences Chair and Professor of Peacemaking and Conflict Management, among other things. Carlos Juarez, thank you for being here. We will have another conversation. Yes, we will talk about foreign policy. That'll probably be the next one. Glad you were able to join us, too. I will see you back here tomorrow morning for the conversation. In the meantime, have a good evening. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Aloha.